Galatians chapter 6, if you're just coming in, glad to have each in class. I'm researching and writing on courage this month, and so today we're going to study about courage and cowardice. If you've watched very many television shows or movies, then you know these words. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can or will be used against you in a court of law. Those are the Miranda rights, and as citizens of this country, we have the right to remain silent. But as citizens of the kingdom of heaven, there are no Miranda rights. We do not have the right to remain silent in certain situations. As we think about times when we ought to speak up and speak out, we will study various contexts of the Scriptures. Somebody said, well, T.B. Larimore, famous restoration preacher, preached a lot in North Alabama. He said, I would be afraid to be ashamed and ashamed to be afraid. Somebody else said, sometimes silence is golden, but at other times it's just plain yellow. We have such good news to tell. How could we keep silent when there's such good news for the world? Number one, it is a sin to be silent when a brother goes astray. In Luke chapter 15, 4 through 7, Jesus tells the parable about the shepherd who lost a sheep. He had 100, 99 of them were still safe in the fold, but as he counted them that night, when they came back into the fold, perhaps one of them was missing. So he left the 99 and he went out and searched and found the lost lamb, put it on his shoulders, rejoicing, brought it back, and added it back to the fold. When you think about the life of any congregation over a number of years, especially in our time in history and in our part of the world, there is a lot of in and out. People moving in for jobs, moving in for school, moving out because of transfers or because they're moving back from where they grew up. There's a lot of transition in our world. And there are a number of people who are converted in congregations and come in and sit in one of the pews, or maybe they move here from another place to be a part of the university here for a while or to take a job. And then they are part of the congregation. If we're not very careful, someone who's converted, someone who's become a part of the congregation will be in their place for a while, and then they'll begin missing some. Not here on Wednesday nights, not here on Sunday nights sometimes. And then somebody will look around at some point and say, whatever happened to, what was her name? That's a tragedy for someone not to not be in their seat because they've passed away or moved away, but because they've fallen away. Now, in that situation, what is the loving thing for a congregation to do? I guess the golden rule would apply in almost every, perhaps every social situation. Yeah, whatever we would want others to do for us, we should be willing to do for them, Matthew 7:12. If we were fallen away, discouraged, back in the world after having been saved, would we want to be neglected? Would we want to be ignored? Would we be happy that no one ever checked on us? Or would we feel like, well, somebody surely will ask, somebody surely will come by, somebody surely will inquire as to my health or my situation. In Galatians 6 and verse 1, there is the working orders for churches, for Christians. If you say, well, who's going to make the visit? Who is going to go see the person? Well, Hebrews 13, 17 says that elders or shepherds watch for our souls. So it starts with the elders who are shepherds of all the flock. But the rule of thumb really should be this. Whoever is going to be the most effective at bringing this person back ought to make an effort to reach out and bring them back. And that normally will be persons who are either related to them or have been close friends with them in the congregation. It's hard to say no to somebody that you know loves you and that you love and have known a long time and have shared a lot of common experiences. So, if someone is straying away, become discouraged, who needs to go talk to them? Well, the elders should and could and can and will, but it also is a responsibility, according to Galatians 6 and verse 1, brethren, if any man be overtaken in a fault. It doesn't say shepherds in this verse, it just says brethren. If any man be overtaken in a fault, some sin has crept back into his life, or he's having some personal issue that's caused him to lose his will to be faithful in the services and in his life. Ye which are spiritual. Well, it would be hypocritical for someone to go and try to get someone else to live right if they weren't living right themselves, if they were not living a spiritual life. And perhaps this also would indicate those who are spiritually strong, those who are wise in years and experience would certainly be under consideration there. Restore such an one in the spirit of meekness. This word restore, I read, was a medical term that would be used of a doctor who is repairing a broken bone. Now, if you break a bone and you go to the doctor, you want him to be as gentle and easy with that restoration process as possible. Don't hurt me worse, I'm already hurting. And so when we go visit someone, it ought not to be with a condemning attitude or a better, more holy than thou, better than thou attitude, but we go in meekness, the last part of the verse, considering thyself lest thou also be tempted. We recognize that in the ebb and flow, up and down of life, that we may be on the other side of that visit at some time in the future. Hopefully not, but it's not beyond the realm of a possibility that someone will be making that kind of visit to me at some time later. Certainly, we ought to be gentle, we ought to be loving and careful, but we ought to not let it pass without some words. It's a sin to be silent when a brother has strayed away. In some congregations, I read, and I guess this would be true to some degree in every congregation, but in some congregations that have been established a long time, there are said to be more unfaithful members in the community or the city than there are those who gather on a given Sunday. I suppose that would be rare, but you don't have to look very long through old church directories or just going through your mind if you've been a member of a congregation for a long time, that there are those in every church who've strayed and who need to be brought back as that sheep or that lamb out in the wilderness is at danger, so a soul separated from the Lord is at danger. All right, let's move on to our second time. It is a sin to be silent. It is a sin to be silent when the defenseless need a voice. In every culture, in every nation, in every society or community, there are those who are vulnerable to abuse by those who are strong. It has happened in our culture. Those who are weak are sometimes run over by those who are strong and greedy or desirous of something that they have. Isaiah 58:1 would be our first verse on this one. Cry aloud, spare not, lift up thy voice like a trumpet, and show my people their transgressions. Don't spare to speak when there are the defenseless who need a voice. Now, we might not be in that group that's defenseless. We might not be the ones who are abused, but we have a voice. We ought to use it in there to speak for them. Edmund Burke said, all that is necessary for evil to triumph is that good men do nothing. neglect, be busy about our affairs, not worry about others. I read about World War II history, an anecdote that comes out of that section of time. In Germany, there were said to be two kinds of churches. Here's Hitler's rise to power, the Third Reich, and they begins his assault on Europe and then beyond. There were churches, all kinds of churches in Germany at the time, and most of them were known as silent churches. They just ignored the political upheaval that was going on and the atrocities that were being perpetrated on the weak and their society first and then others. And then there were churches that were called the praying, confessing churches. And those churches were the ones who had a voice of opposition against Hitler. One of those preachers who was, I guess, among, maybe the best known was Martin Niemöller. He didn't die until 1984, born in 1892, just to give you the historical context. And he spoke out strongly against Hitler, spent the last 7 years in concentration camps, although he wasn't a Jew. And he's best known for this little quote. "First they came for the socialist, but I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionist, but I did not speak out, for I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, but I did not speak out, for I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one else left to speak out." Who in our culture needs a voice? Who could be more innocent and yet more vulnerable than the babe in the womb? Did you know that if you combined the murders of Pharaoh, Herod, and Hitler together, it would not equal the atrocities that have been perpetrated on the innocent in the womb in our nation in modern times? More than 57 million babies have been killed in their own mother's womb in our lifetime, in our country. Did you know that if you crush an eagle's egg, you could be fined $5,000 and spend time in jail? But if you will crush a baby's skull in its mother's womb, you can be paid very handsomely for that. Is that not? Is there not a need for us to speak out and be the voice for the defenseless? Yes. That's right. That's exactly right. That's the mechanism that leads to that result so often, isn't it? Children born to those who are not ready to be parents to them. I read of Nikita Khrushchev, who's premier of Soviet Union, and he had been in Joseph Stalin's cabinet before he rose to power. After he became premier, he was critical of Stalin. And if you know anything about Stalin, he was a monster. The most conservative estimate is that he murdered 20 million of his own people. And it may have been as many as 60 million Russians died from Stalin. He would starve whole villages, for instance. He would send in his army and mass murder men, women, and children. He was a horrific person. Well, Khrushchev was in his cabinet, rose to power after he became premier. He was critical of Stalin, and he was speaking once to a large audience outside, and he began to criticize Stalin and some of the policies. And there was a heckler in the crowd, that spoke out in a very loud voice, carried, "You were in his cabinet. Why didn't you say something?" And Khrushchev stopped. And he stared into the audience. And he pounded his fist. And he said, "Who said that?" And he waited 30 seconds, 45 seconds. And then he said, there was not a peep. And then he said, "Now you know why I didn't say anything." The defenseless need a voice. And it's not politically correct to be a voice. But Christians are not in the business of being politically correct. We're in the business of being lights in a world, leaven and salt in a society, and a voice to speak out, to spare not, to cry aloud. Number three, it's a sin to be silent when a sinner needs the gospel. "Go ye into all the world, preach the gospel to every creature. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. He that believeth not shall be damned." Now, I quote that verse, or Brandon or Chance, almost every Lord's Day. Now, that verse, Mark 16, 15 and 16, probably quoted more than any other single verse in our assemblies. And I think after we've heard it so many times, it may just in one ear and out the other, or "I already know that," or "I've heard that before." But that verse does not become chewed gum just because we've heard it before. It's just as powerful and just as meaningful and just as important this morning as it was the first time we ever heard it. All the world, every creature. That's every zip code, every latitude on planet Earth, and every person who lives in every house, hamlet, village, city, urban, out in the boondocks, wherever they are, they need to hear the gospel. Because the stakes are so high that hearing the gospel and being obedient to it means that they will one day hear the words, "Well done, good and faithful servant, enter into the joys of thy Lord." And not having heard and not having obeyed means that they one day will hear the words, "Depart from me, I don't know you," or "I never knew you." And that will be an end that's too horrible even to give much contemplation to. Now, the grass not back there. Daniel, can you put up the words to the song, "When in the Better Land"? You never mentioned him to me is probably the title of it. This is an old song that we've sung a lot of times, but I was thinking about how to illustrate this point. And while he's looking that up, it's not possible to be able to talk to every person we meet every day about the gospel. I've thought a lot about this point. I don't want to make us feel guilty about this. I'd like to encourage us and motivate us to pick our opportunities to talk to those that we think we can have influence with. There are those who we come in contact with in our families who need the gospel, among our friends, and we can't go into work every day and talk to every person, and we wouldn't be able to do the work that we're supposed to do. In our communities, people might consider us to be, they need to trust us and know that we are people of love and people with good sense. And so I'm encouraging us to overcome our fears and to use our intelligence to pick the best times to share the gospel with sinners. Overcome the fear of not knowing enough. You know, we may say to ourselves, "I would talk to people, but I don't know enough to do that. I'm not a preacher. I'm not a Bible teacher. Or I've only been a Christian for a little while and I don't know all that I think I need to know. Or what if they were to ask me a question?" Well, we may not know enough, but how will we learn if we don't jump in the water? How do you learn to swim unless you get wet? And we can always say, "Well, that's a good question. I'll find an answer to it." But we know more than we give ourselves credit for. Number two, we might have the fear of, "I'm afraid I'll offend somebody." My experience is that most people are not offended if you talk to them about the gospel. They enjoy talking. And if you had the right attitude, then they're not offended at all. But even if they were offended, we usually can smooth the waters. We can help them by being kind. And the other question to ask is, would it be better to risk offending someone or risk them never having heard the gospel? Fear of rejection, number three. But Jesus suffered rejection for us on the cross. Fear of ridicule, very rare, very unlikely, but if it were to happen, we should be glad to suffer shame for His name, Acts 4:20. Fear of persecution, well, in some cases it might bring it, but if it did, God would bless us because of it. All right, were you able to find it? It's not in our book at all? Okay. I don't know that I can quote it, but you've heard that song, "When in the Better Land, before the bar we stand, how deeply grieved our souls would be if any lost one there should cry in deep despair, you never mentioned him to me." Aren't those moving lyrics? To project ourselves to the judgment day with those that we've known and cared about and worked with and lived near and been related to, and for them to be able to say, you never told me? You knew this and you never said anything. How could you do that? Well, again, I don't want to make us feel guilty. I'd like to motivate us to think, well, I can do something. I can invite. I can engage. I can teach. God did not communicate truth to us to be buried, but to be proclamated. And what about this? Can you imagine Andrew having met the Messiah, not telling Peter, John 1:40 and 41? We have found the Messiah. He was excited about it. Can you imagine the disciples after the resurrection keeping that a secret? I mean, Jesus is alive and them not telling anybody that He had come back from the grave? That's unthinkable. Acts 4:20 says, we cannot but speak the things which we have seen and heard. We got to say it. Good news has a way of finding its way into conversations. And so, this is good news that we have to share. Number four, it's a sin to be silent when a church is veering from the truth. Look at Galatians chapter 1, verses 6 through 9. I've had this thought through the years a lot of times. You know, you go into big cities sometimes as preachers, and these congregations that at one time were well known in our brotherhood, I'm thinking of one out in Texas that I won't mention, but well known throughout the brotherhood for good works and sound doctrine. But today, if you were to visit in that city, you would not feel comfortable worshiping there because they brought in instruments. They don't preach the same gospel from the pulpit that they did in times past. Well, how did that happen? I wasn't there. I couldn't say specifically, but I know how the devil usually works that. One eldership begins to pass the reins to younger men of necessity. They gradually cease to emphasize the same points of doctrine that were emphasized with the previous eldership or the previous pulpit. Maybe the members say, we know all that doctrinal stuff. Why do you keep preaching on the fundamentals? I've heard that. Tell us something that will help us in our practical lives. And then the children grow up without having heard it, without having learned why we do what we do. And then they bring in a preacher perhaps trained in a school that doesn't have strong convictions about what is truth and what isn't, or what should be practiced and what shouldn't in worship. And then before long, the waters are tested a little bit. We need to expand the role of women, a little bit. Would it be okay if they led the prayer in the Bible classes? Not in the worship, but just in a Bible class. So that'd be okay. Just in the young adult class. Then, we could have instruments between the Bible class and the worship just played over the PA system. Not during the worship itself, just as background music. And then, we have a lot of people that like to have an instrumental service, so we'll have it at 8:15 and then the traditional service at 10:15. And as soon as all the gray hairs that were attending the traditional service are gone, it won't be anymore. You see how that transition is made? What if somebody had spoken up early in that process and said to the elders, this drifting away from the truth is not, this isn't a good decision. Now, it could be, well, let me read some verses. I'll come back to that. Look, go with me to Galatians 1, 6 through 9. I marvel, Galatians 1, 6, that ye are so soon removed from Him that called you into the grace of Christ unto another gospel. Another gospel, different teaching, different practice, which is not another, not a real one. There's only one real gospel. But there be some that trouble you. There always will be those who will test the waters, itching ear preachers, and would pervert the gospel of Christ. But though we are an angel from heaven, doesn't matter how much prestige, how good a speaker, how intelligent, how popular, even if it was an angel, you shouldn't follow it. Preach any other gospel unto you than that which we have preached unto you, let him be accursed. Ephesians 5:11. I'll take the time. I could quote it to you, and I will quote it. But look, flip over a few pages till you get to Ephesians 5:11. And have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness. Would perverting the gospel be an unfruitful work of darkness? Yes, it would. Have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them. You see that, the last part? Not be silent about it, but reprove. Joshua 7:10 in the Old Testament, there was sin in the camp of Israel, but sin in the camp should be openly and audibly spoken against. What was it that the Lord did in Revelation chapters 2 and 3? He gave an assessment of the seven churches of Asia, and some of them were favorable. Some of them were unfavorable. Most of them were mixed. But he spoke out and said, these are the things that need to happen lest your candlestick be removed from you. And you think about that process, going back to the illustration or the application of the church that's drifting away from the truth. What if, that's probably going to take a 20 years or so. Sometimes less, but generally you're talking about not a 2-year process, but 10 times that. But what if somebody and several somebodies had started back, 19 years ago and said, where are we going? What's the reason for this change? Where's the scripture that would say this would be a good practice for the congregation? And someone might say, well, I'm just a little old lady in a congregation. Did you know the elders listen to little old ladies? Somebody says, I'm just a young person. I'm just a teen. Did you know the elders listen to teens? You say, I haven't been here that long. Do you have a voice? Do you have faith in the Scriptures? Are you able to point to this verse and say what it means? Ezekiel 33:2-7 speaks of a watchman on the wall. And the figure there is, in ancient times, you had a walled city, people lived inside of it, and you had towers, various places around it. And so at night, or when there were times of danger, sometimes always, there'd be someone in the tower, and his job was to scan the horizon and make sure that no enemies were coming. And if there were an enemy coming, to spot as soon as possible and sound the warning so they could close the gates and prepare themselves. And people that lived outside the walls could get in so they'd be protected. Now, if that watcher on the wall saw the enemy coming but didn't say anything, and he came in and attacked, then the blood of the innocent, the blood of the people that died would be on his hands. He knew it and he didn't say anything. If he sounded the warning and the citizens didn't shut the gates, they didn't believe him, then their blood's on their own hands. He has cleared himself of guilt. And the application that Ezekiel is making in that chapter 33 is that we have that responsibility of a watchman on the wall. We are to warn others if there is sin in the camp. If there is, you could make it even a sin in a life, in an individual life, but especially would that be true in the larger context of like a city or a church and that, or the brotherhood. So sound the warning. If they heed it, then they're saved and everyone's happy. But if they don't heed it, at least the one who sounded the warning, who goes before God in judgment later, can say, I did what I was supposed to do, and then that will be their responsibility if they did not listen to it. There's a Latin proverb that says, he who is silent when he ought to have spoken and was able to, is taken to agree. We say it shorter today, same meaning, silence gives consent. If something has happened, we don't speak up, then we are thought to be in favor of it. And so if we're not in favor, we should speak up. Numbers 20:24, this is an interesting chapter that deals with when Moses struck the rock, when he was told to speak to the rock. And Moses and Aaron usually work together. And on this occasion, they were together, but it was all, everything you read is what Moses did. Moses said, Moses did, Aaron's in the background. But Numbers 20:24 says that Aaron rebelled against God. How did he rebel? He didn't lead the people. He didn't say anything. He didn't strike the rock. Perhaps it is exactly at this point that Aaron did not use his influence to stop Moses from doing what Moses should not have done. In Acts 8 and verse 1, Saul was consenting unto the death of the Christians. But when you read that carefully, there's no words that are recorded that Saul said. As far as we know, Saul of Tarsus did not pick up any of the rocks and stone the Christians to death. They just laid their coats at his feet. But because he was in agreement with it, and he was even, in that case, the leader of it, he participated in the guilt of it, and later would say that he was the chief of sinners because he was guilty of shedding the blood of the innocent Christians. I think we have time for one additional one. Sin, it is a sin to be silent when the honor of Christ is at stake. The Prussian King Frederick the Great was known to be a great agnostic. And he had a general, von Zeeland, who was known to be a believer in Christ. At a great banquet, Frederick the Great, after the wine had flowed, he got up and he began to regale the audience with some crude humor, and he began to mock Christ. And everybody was rolling with laughter, except General von Zeeland, who sat near the front, stone-faced. Finally, after that had gone on for a little while, General von Zeeland stood at attention at his place. An old man, well-respected, military uniform, and he stood until the king recognized him. And he said, Sire, you know that I have not feared death. I have fought and won 38 battles for you. I am an old man. I shall soon have to go into the presence of one greater than you, the mighty God who saved me from my sin, the Lord Jesus Christ, whom you are blaspheming. I salute you, Sire, as an old man who loves his Savior on the edge of eternity. And it was extremely quiet in that banquet hall as the king stared at him. And finally the king said with a trembling voice, Sir, I beg your pardon. I beg your pardon. And the banquet was dismissed. The honor of Christ is not to be cast into the dirt. It is not to be mocked and laughed about and made the butt of jokes in our presence. The honor of our King is to be defended, even with our lives. Mark 8:38, Jesus said, Whosoever shall be ashamed of me and of my words in this sinful and adulterous generation, of him shall the Son of Man be ashamed when he cometh in his glory. In the year 156, and we'll end with this, in the year 156 AD, there was an 86-year-old Christian named Polycarp who was arrested and brought before a Roman tribunal. And the proconsul said, "Curse Christ and I'll release you." And Polycarp refused. He was given a second opportunity. "Curse Christ, renounce your atheism, and you'll be released." To them, an atheist was someone who didn't worship Caesar or the Roman gods. A Christian was an atheist in Rome. And again, he refused. The third time, and the proconsul didn't want to punish an 86-year-old man, but he felt he had to do what the law said. He could not be made an example of. And Polycarp knew that the stakes were high. He would either be thrown into an arena with a hungry wild animal, or they would burn him at the stake. So the third time he was asked, "Renounce Christ and I will release thee." And Polycarp said, 86 years have I served him and he has done me no wrong. How can I blaspheme my king who saved me?" And they made a pyre, set it on fire, and burned him to death at 86 years of age. But his words still ring true down to our present hour. "I'm not ashamed to own my Lord, nor to defend his cause," Isaac Watts said. "When the honor of Christ is at stake, it is a sin to be silent." We will be dismissed to the worship hour. Thank you for your attention.